it please the court? I'm Dorothy Tomasetti, registration number 7665, and I'm appearing today on behalf of Susan Nusky, who is the respondent appellant in this matter. This case, I call it the trickle-down effect case, because from my perspective and my reading of the case and my argument and position here today, in step one of the court's findings, prior to entering permanent orders in this case, the court made an error. And that error was significant, and it formed the basis of all other orders in that case, and it significantly affected the rights and responsibilities of the parties as they were spelled out in the permanent orders. And the error itself resulted in a significant, harmful disadvantage to my client that is so severe that the order represents an abuse of discretion, and from our position, the orders for allocation of debt as set forth in the permanent orders, for maintenance and attorney's fees cannot stand. It is also my position that while the prevailing case law would require the court on remand to reconsider its orders for maintenance. Maintenance was denied. My client, Susan Nusky's request for maintenance was denied. And attorney's fees, because division of property and or in this case, debt and maintenance and attorney's fees are inextricably intertwined. I submit to this court that if this family had no assets and no liabilities, basing it on the criteria in 1410.114 for, first of all, the threshold requirement for maintenance and the criteria for awarding maintenance, Ms. Nusky, it was an abuse of discretion for Ms. Nusky not to receive maintenance. Likewise, with attorney's fees, 1410.119, given the total circumstances of the parties, their relative inabilities to earn money, the fact that substantially all of Mr. Dryge's attorney's fees had been paid prior to trial with earnings or marital funds, it was an abuse of discretion for my client not to receive attorney's fees. And the effect of that order has created and will continue to create a hardship for her. Finally, I'm asking the court today, or will ask the court, to enter an award of attorney's fees for Ms. Nusky. Because of the extreme hardship that this order has caused, she has no ability to pay for fees for an appeal, and it is yet one more burden to a woman who is overburdened with debt caused by a wrongful assumption or wrongful finding and a subsequent allocation of marital debt and refusal of her other requests. Just so I am clear about the error that I am speaking of, it is undisputed that the $56,657 debt that was owed to Dennis Noon by Mr. Dryja's business, or Mr. Dryja in the course of his business, was not a debt that was paid or that remains to be paid with the party's ongoing earnings from employment and business. Although the court included on the that debt on the allocation of debts.
Ms. Tomasetti, I'm going to interrupt you for a minute.
Okay.
The court identified this as a marital debt.
That's correct.
Tell us, or tell me in particular, that why is it not a marital debt?
I don't disagree that it's a marital debt. It certainly is a marital debt. The court treated it as a debt that needed to be paid with the parties from the earnings that the court found the parties had at that time. For example, the court found that Mr. Neske made $124,000 a year and that Ms. Neske made approximately $31,000 a year. The court treated that debt as though those resources, the earnings of the parties, needed to be used or had to be used to pay that debt going forward.
Not clear to me from the worksheet that you have on page 6. Uh-huh. It appears to me that the court allocated that debt to be paid by husband, and husband, from the rest of the record, husband was to hold wife harmless from liability on that debt.
That is correct, Your Honor. The fallacy in the court's reasoning is, I mean, the court's reasoning is stated, it's pervasive in the permanent orders. The debt has been divided 80-20, 80% to Mr. Dreisha, 20% to Ms. Neske, because that is the proportion of their incomes to one another. The combined incomes, Mr. Neske had 80%, Mr. Dreisha, excuse me, had 80%, Ms. Neske had 20. The court is assuming in this allocation of debt that Mr. Dreisha has to pay that from his earnings of $124,000 a year. And that is inaccurate, and it's indisputed that the court is wrong about that. And the appellee in his brief indicates that it's undisputed that that is paid in kind of an unusual way, really. Mr. Neske had a business relationship for a long time with a man named Dennis Moon, who provided the software and the support services that I apologize, I keep saying Mr. Neske when I mean Mr. Dreisha, I should say husband. Husband and Mr. Noon had a long-standing business relationship. There was a long-standing debt to Mr. Noon. Mr. Noon got irritated with Mr. Dreisha, husband, and said, we need to make arrangements to pay the debt. The agreement between the parties, and this is undisputed, between Mr. Neske, Mr. Dreisha and Mr. Noon, is that Mr. Dreisha will send all of the income from his one major client in his medical billing business to Mr. Noon. Mr. Noon will pay all of the expenses of Mr. Dreisha's business, including $2,000 a month to himself to discharge that debt of $56,000. Then Mr. Noon agreed to pay $9,000 a month to Mr. Dreisha as a contract employee. So the debt is being paid as a business expense and not as an ongoing debt that is to be paid by the parties.
Ms. Tomasetti, that's referred to as wife and husband. So wife has been held harmless for this debt. And uh-huh. Is there anything in the court's ruling that is requiring her to pay any of this debt?
No, Your Honor, the error is the court has included, the court has found of the debts that need to be paid, it's equitable for Mr. Dreisha, husband, to pay 80% and Ms. Neske, wife, to pay 20% because that stands in proportion to their gross earnings. The $56,000 is already being paid by the business. So it results in a disproportionate allocation of debt to Ms. Neske. Ms. Neske is paying $33,000 of the marital debt, or it's been allocated to her, when if that $56,000 had not been included on the balance sheet, Ms. Neske would have paid let's see, I don't have exact, What I have is her proportion. I don't have it. I think we found that it costs her $19,000. The number is in the brief.
But does Tomasetti do it?
An extra $19,000.
So let me see if I understand your argument. Your argument is that the court abused its discretion when it based its division of marital debt on the proportionate income of the parties, because an item that the court included to be paid by husband, it will not be paid by husband. It's going to be paid, as I understand your argument, by a third party, by a business that is not husband.
No, that's not, it's close, but not quite. The $56,000 debt is a debt that is being paid by a business operated by Mr. Neske, just as his rent, his secretary's salary, for example, comes off the top as a business expense, so does this $56,000. It's a marital debt to the extent that it was incurred during the marriage, but it is in fact a business debt that's being paid out of the gross proceeds of the business, and before he has his gross income from business of $9,000.
So as the court figures out this formula, the court looks at the draw or the net that husband takes after certain expenses have been paid by the corporation.
Exactly, Your Honor. And it trickles down from there. They treat him as an individual who's earning $9,000 plus some additional income from other sources when the court makes its orders, instead of and of course that $56,000, it's essentially double dipping to include that. I will at this point stand on my brief because I would like to reserve time for rebuttal, but I would submit that even in the absence of this error, which makes the allocation of debt an abuse of discretion, that even in the absence of this error, for reasons that are set out in the brief, and considering the disparate financial circumstances of the parties, the court's denial of an award of maintenance to Ms. Neske that was not based on consideration of all of the statutory factors, and the court's denial of attorney's fees was an abuse of discretion and should be overturned in equity. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Diane Lindquist, and I am appellate counsel for petitioner below, appellee above, Richard Dreja. There were some very interesting things that the appellant stated. That she stated that if the family had no assets and no liabilities, the trial court may have committed an abuse of discretion by not awarding attorney's fees, by not awarding maintenance. However, that was not the case here. These people, the operative fact in this case is that the parties and their business were insolvent. Although there are many business entities here that have similar names, such that it gets a bit confusing, the only marital business was DNA Colorado, or as I have referred to it in my brief, DNAC. All the other entities with similar names are owned by other people, operated by other people, and the liabilities for those companies are not affiliated with these parties. They were not attributed to these parties. So the fact is these parties had very few assets at the time of dissolution, and their debts were hundreds of thousands of dollars. As the court noted, they had been living beyond their means for many years prior to the dissolution in order to get to the financial condition that they were in at that time. It most certainly was disputed that husband, DNA, well, let me go back. DNAC has no proceeds. It has no assets. It has nothing. The only reason it is still operational is because the husband here needs to have group health insurance because he's ill, and he must continue having group health insurance, and that was the only entity through which he could keep group health insurance. Mr. Noon owns the company that pays Mr. Dreisach. Mr. Noon owns the company. He pays Mr. Dreisach $9,000 per month. He takes an additional $2,000 of Mr. Dreisach's income and applies it toward that $56,000 debt. That is evidenced by Mr. Dreisach's tax returns, which show that he is paying taxes on that extra $2,000. That was on page 3 of our answer brief. It explains exactly how that works. DNAC does not have proceeds that they are paying toward the $56,000 debt that it had incurred as for the purpose of converting the software to actually a billing system itself. I think as my brief explained, DNAC was a company that was a distributorship for a medical software billing company. Instead of selling the software itself, the parties converted the software into billing. A billing service for clients rather than selling the software itself. Mr. Noon stepped in and revoked the license to distribute the software and took over the only client that DNAC had left at that point, and his new company, and I would have to say that was DNAC Data Management Systems or something, handles all the only clients that they had. Again, DNAC is only operative so that Mr. Dreisach can continue getting health insurance on a group basis through DNAC.
So does husband get a paycheck from somebody?
He does.
Okay, who does he get a paycheck from?
He gets a paycheck from the company called DNA Data Management Systems, which is owned by a man named Dennis Noon. It's a parent company to the distributorship.
So he's an employee.
Correct.
Well, he's not self-employed.
Contractor.
Okay.
And so therefore, DNA Data Management Systems cannot give him health insurance because he's not an employee of the company. That's why he keeps DNA Colorado open for the sole purpose of providing him health insurance.
DNA Colorado performs no services for anybody, has no income as a separate entity.
That is correct.
Has no expenses other than his health insurance.
That is correct.
And my impression from Ms. Tomasetti is that Data Systems of California is paying the $56,000 debt.
It is not. It is Mr. Dreisach from his monthly paycheck. $2,000 of that is going to pay the $56,000 debt.
So that's deducted out of the $9,000 per month paycheck?
That is correct.
And the record shows that?
Yes, it does. And the testimony shows that. And the judge had obviously understood that to be the case. I don't think he would have made the division of debt what it was if he was not clear on that point. And we are clear on that point. It is a confusing situation because so many companies are named, the entities all have similar names. And it is hard to understand, but the only entity that was ever owned by these parties was DNA Colorado, which is now essentially defunct.
Just to clarify a little point here. So is the $2,000 coming out of the $9,000, or would the paycheck have been $11,000 but for the $2,000 taken?
You know, actually, and I'll be honest with you, I am not quite sure exactly what the, I did it in round figures. I believe that his paycheck would be $10,300 and they take $2,000 out of that, is the way I understand it. And I believe that is in the record. I just, unfortunately, I didn't look at those specifics today before I came, and I thought I had addressed those in the brief. But I think what the major problem here is the confusion over, or after I reread the briefs, I should say, was confusion over what a hold harmless provision is. In the reply brief, it seemed that the appellant was confused about what a hold harmless provision is. And we couldn't find any Colorado family law cases that actually define a hold harmless provision. But so I looked it up just under Black's Law Dictionary, and it is obviously a term that relates to contracts. It's also referred to as an indemnity clause, and it is a provision where one party agrees to answer for any liability or harm that the other party might incur, meaning future, might incur in the future. Mr. Dreja was ordered to hold her harmless in the future, which he has done. However, the hold harmless clause should not affect the division of marital property, and it should not affect the definition of marital property, and it certainly should not relieve the protected party from paying their share of the debt. And I think that based on the briefs, there was confusion with that because the court had held her harmless, appellant believed that she was no longer liable to pay her share of the debt. And I, since there are no family law cases that define a hold harmless provision, I would ask this court to publish this case only so that it is out there if this happens again in the future. I believe that that is what has led to the entire confusion in this case.
Let me try to straighten this out. All right. Was she liable jointly and severally for the $56,000?
Yes.
Okay. The domestic relations court can't change that.
Correct.
She's still liable for it, but to the extent that the creditor seeks to recover from her, husband has to hold her harmless.
Correct.
Now, what does that have to do with the allocation of debt?
Well, it shouldn't, but in the briefs, that was the overriding theme about why there was an abuse of discretion, because wife should not have been allocated debt from which she has been held harmless. That was stated over and over and over in both the opening brief and the reply brief.
Well, and let me take another tack at this. Your opposing counsel seems to argue that the operative fact here is that the $56,000 is being paid by some third party, which I think was Judge Carparelli's terminology, through Mr. Noon. Are you saying that that's inaccurate, and in fact the payment of the $56,000 comes through an offset against Mr. Dreja's monthly paycheck?
I am saying that that is incorrect. It comes out of Mr. Dreja's monthly paycheck. He pays income tax on the $2,000 that is applied each month toward the $56,000.
No matter how much or how little this third party pays Mr. Noon's company, it's still roughly $2,000 a month out of Mr. Dreja's paycheck goes to the $56,000.
That is correct.
Thank you.
And the only reason that this is the first time I've actually heard that was their argument, I'm sorry to say, after reading the briefs again and again, it was that if she's held harmless from that debt, it should not have been divided 80-20. And that's what we've heard so far. And I think, well, that's what I had heard. So I'm glad to see that we could at least clear that part up. The other part of that same argument, and I am running short on time, so I'll try to get through that quickly, is that the wife stated that she shouldn't have to pay the joint income tax bill for the year 2007 because it wasn't divided between the parties, when in fact it was. There were the spreadsheet on page 6 of the appellant's brief was unsecured debts. There were also secured debts between the parties that weren't listed on that spreadsheet. The court went through all of them and found them to be the 2007 joint income tax bill for $9,865. Then, of course, the DNAC debt that was the software conversion, was $18,995. The collectible car storage fees were $8,200. And Wife's bankruptcy lawyer was $10,495. The court considered those all to be marital debts, but secured apparently, but the total came to $47,555. If you divide that 80-20, husband would have paid $38,044. 20%, the wife would have paid $9,511. Rather than having them each go in and say, okay, I'll throw in this amount and you throw in that amount, the judge very wisely just ordered particular people to pay particular debts.
Does the particular people pay particular debts roughly get to 80-20 if you accumulate the his and hers column?
It came within $300 of 80-20.
Thank you.
So it's just a factually incorrect argument because the judge did divide all that by 80-20, and they just allocated that particular debt for her to pay, so that I think it's obvious, just the simplicity of the matter, that she would pay. It came within $300. Finally, on the maintenance, the court heard testimony about how much the parties earned, how much each party had been allocated, and the court specifically found that there was a very disproportionate division of debt, marital debt, in this case, so with husband being the vast majority of the debt. Moreover, the wife was awarded the only marital assets that were left. She was awarded her 401k. She was awarded a car. Her 401k was about $18,000, give or take a few dollars. The car was worth approximately $3,000. She had a Charles Schwab account of $23,000. And altogether, her property worth was over $40,000. That's the only thing they had left. Husband was awarded $1,800, a car that was worth a 1998, by the way, worth $1,800. Now, we agree that wife's property division was not large, but there wasn't any property to divide. There wasn't anything left because the parties had lived beyond their means for so long.
I'm just exhausted.
Okay. I think I'm done.
I would like to call the court's attention to my brief, page 21, where I say very clearly, moreover, petitioner's business debt is being paid by the business, according to Moon's testimony and petitioner's, in order to discharge the debt. And in my brief, I cite to the record, which is Dennis Noon's testimony. And Dennis Noon, in the areas that are cited, we first talk about the negotiations between Mr. Noon. And again, this negotiation is motivated by Mr. Noon's desire to get paid. This bill was delinquent. And it starts on page 40 of the record transcript, where they talk about the negotiation between them, where he talks about the first $2,000 going against the debt, then reimbursements for expenses and payroll, and then Richard, this is Mr. Dreja, would get his monthly retainer. And then it goes on with more testimony, but it says, Mr. Noon says on page 42, keep in mind that the first person to be paid in this arrangement basically was me. That's why I made the arrangement. And on page 42, Richard's retainer for $9,000, which is basically like an independent contractor type number. There's no deductions or anything taken out of it. It's not a payroll. It was.
Does Mr. Dreja pay state and federal income tax on the approximately $2,000 that is being withheld to discharge this debt?
Your Honor, it is my recollection that there had been no income taxes filed or prepared by Mr. Dreja that referenced, in fact, I don't think taxes hadn't been filed and paid for some time. And secondly, I would direct the court's attention to Mr. Dreja's own financial affidavit that I believe shows the $9,000 with no deduction from Mr. Noon. So arguably, a contra argument would be his income for the purposes of apportioning debt, if that's the court's intent, would be $11,000, not $9,000, if we add that $9,000 back in.
So let me just quickly ask you. So it's not in the record then whether or not there was income tax paid? Was that before the trial court?
There was no evidence. But I recall in my recollections pretty strong about the tax returns.
Both counsel exhausted their time.
Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course.